This is a production of Cornell University.
I'd like to thank Barbara and David Zelaznik for their generous support of our reading series. And we're also very grateful to Sarah Rice and Marianne Marsh for their indispensable help, as always. Before we begin, could I ask everybody to please turn off your electronic paraphernalia so we can have an unplugged interlude? Just turn off everything you have. After the reading, there'll be a short Q&A with David. If you there's something you'd like to ask, feel free. Any questions about his poetry or poetry in general, poetics, those questions would be welcome. And then there's a reception on the second floor. You'll find it. Just follow the crowd if you haven't been through that routine before. Okay, so today it's my pleasure to introduce David Baker, one of the finest poets of his generation. David has published so many brilliant books that I've almost lost count. I think there are 10 poetry books, and let's see, 4 of prose, including the one that's forthcoming. He has an essay collection coming out in 2014 called Show Me Your Environment. His honors include prizes and grants from the Guggenheim Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and his latest book of poems, Never Ending Birds, received the Theodore Retke Memorial Poetry Prize in 2011. David holds the Thomas B. Fordham Chair at Denison University in Granville, Ohio, and he's poetry editor of the Kenyon Review. I'll say a few words about his latest collection, and I think that's the book he's going to be reading from. Okay. Few are the words for finding. That simple statement serves as epigraph to never-ending birds, and it quietly suggests its opposite. Many are the words for losing. Despite the counterweights of memory and writing, it is loss that seems never-ending in Baker's profoundly elegiac book of changes. A marriage ends, the rural Midwest is decimated by exurban developments, and language itself is endangered, a witness to its own dismemberment. In the poem The Rumor, for instance, lovers' initials carved in a tree grow out of reach and swollen beyond legibility. But Never-Ending Birds also is a nest of reinscription. The books, large themes of loss and regeneration are enacted through quotation. Passages from field guides, 17th century medical books, the meditations of the Puritan Edward Taylor, 19th century Shaker gift messages, all of these quotes become a memorial to lost rhetorics and an act of resurrection, a gesture both elegiac and custodial. As language is repurposed, its provenance lingers, and contemporary registers are fractured by the past. Baker's powerful weave of quotes inevitably reminds me of Marianne Moore's exquisite borrowings. Like Moore's, Baker's poems are richly detailed, full of information, transfigured by metrics and music. His poems have something of her precision, attentive observation, and scrupulous tone. He is both curator and reassembler, focusing on words with almost fetishistic intensity to create a cross-referential, elusive collage imbued with linguistic sparks and semiotic leaps. The practical instructions and agricultural observations of Virgil's Georgics are spliced to a lyrical Keatsian lushness. But rather than pastoral epiphanies, Baker's poems offer troubled witness to a vanishing rural America, and they voice the tension between fabricated and natural worlds. Nature is feral, but its domestication also figures, in a dog that comes when called, an oxygen tank that tames the air, pruned miniatures, and split rails. Though etymologies abound in the book, denotations are slippery. Bright Pitch, that's the poem title, Bright Pitch begins by describing the destruction of wooden barns in Ohio and notes that barn was also a code word during the Manhattan Project's work on the atomic bomb. The word pitch shifts from tar to the semi-salacious come-ons of advertising, sales pitches that want to blow us away. Such poems replace nostalgia with a testimony of metamorphosis as a book that began with loss travels through stages of renovation. The poem, Tis a Failing, considers America's beginnings and offers a delicate typology of remorse. The moralistic guilt of the Puritans morphs into a larger contrition, a collective fall from grace, as the poem alludes to both 9/11 and U.S. war crimes. In other poems, new love appears, figured as honey, as a second tornado. In The Feast, Baker notes, birds will be back as though nothing has happened. Yet so much has happened in this beautifully complex collection where austere surfaces implode and cross-references expand. Like all great poetry, Baker's work rewards multiple readings, and I was struck and staggered by the depths as I reread, at once somber and gorgeous, elegant and casual. Never-ending Birds unfolds with surreptitious grace. Its reservoirs of meaning come to light gradually in lines so packed and fibrillant they seem to delve into the page, incise it, even as they move across it. I'm grateful that such poetry exists and that the poet capable of writing it is here with us today. Please welcome David Baker.
Come home, the earth utters to the body, and so the body does come home at last. Consider the tufts and tail piece, hooves cleft from the legs, what's left of them where they dropped concentric beneath the beach. Consider the beach, the lover's own tree, this one, yes, hearts scored in and someone's and someone else's initials so swollen they're unreadable and more than head high up the trunk. Up the trunk where the body crawled. Think of that. Furious, rapt hunger. We thought it a rumor when the farmer called the paper, when deputies spotted something. Buff deer, or maybe a Dane running loose in the corn, in the feedlot, three nights running. Look, there is no doubt whatever. So the body, even the lover, comes down to earth, but not this time at first. The big cat dragged the corpse up the tree. They will do that. That's how we know. Cats being climbers with prey they've killed. Up to the bole, the big place, to the crotch of the tree. That's what we call it. And sat, ate, shat, even slept. The claw marks proceed up the tree. The fleshy, dun bark. Blood stripped brown as fox coat or wet sandstone. Blood ascending the tree's evident body. Up the lover's tree. Then the body fell, at least in little pieces, all around the trunk, spattered, strewn aureole of deer guts, bitten skin, bone. The rest went on again in the body of the beast. And so, we hear, the lovers do this too. I was here once before. The summer of 1985, I lived here. I taught in the Telluride House. I have a group of high school students from all over the country, teaching them an American poetry class and creative writing classes. The last time I was in Ithaca. It's so nice to be back here and to see friends and to have gone to Alice's terrific class today. Hi, guys.
Yeah.
And, oh my God, Cornell. My first MLA interview was with Cornell. The very first time, 1983, I think it was. I was a graduate student, first interview out of the blocks. I just bombed it. It was 8:30 in the morning. I had to borrow a tie. I didn't even have a tie. I walk in there, six of you guys sitting around a table. And in the side bedroom was a baby on the bed. I shouldn't be telling you this. A baby on the bed crying. And somebody said, go pick up the baby. I picked up the baby, who immediately barfed all over me and my borrowed tie. And I I mean, MLA nightmare, right? I sat down. The first question, this was for a position in creative writing and poetry. The first question was, let's talk a little about King Lear and Melville's Omoo. Kay, I said, can I clean up first? And I said, Omoo, you know, I had actually read Omoo. I didn't like it. I didn't share that. It was a great question. And about 5 years later, I in the middle of the night, I got the answer. I knew, but it was a little late. So there's that. There's more to say about that, but I won't. Thank you for coming. Thank you for having me here, and thank you for saying all those things. Alice has hosted me a couple of other times, and I'm really grateful for her kindness and her attentions. So I'm going to read another couple of poems from this book, but I think, you know, false advertising, maybe I think I'm going to read some very new poems from some things that I'm working on currently, but one or two more from this book, because we talked about them in class today. This is a poem called Posthumous Man, and we talked about it. Keats, John Keats shows up. That's where the title comes from, in that letter that he wrote near the end of his life about, I seem to be living a posthumous existence. Posthumous Man, I hate the world. I have come to the edge. A neighbor's white bean field in the snow fog, 3 weeks of it shedding in the warmth like smoke from fire lines set against the trees, or the season's cold boredom with itself. Mud in the white field. A hump of gray snow, nothing is there. I hold the dog tight on his leash, gray snow, gray coat. Rising now, scuffed like a bad rug, scruff-eared. So we watch nothing rise in the white bean field and shake off a night's sleep and sniff, sniff, peer over at us. Winter wrens in a fluff. Rustle of bramble, he trots off at precisely 180 degrees from where we emerged from the woods into the woods. The long married abide in privacy, longer and longer. That's one irony. After hearing the coyote crying, a week, 10 days, maybe more, late at night through the glassy air, crying like a bird his song among the billion stars, we saw him sunning asleep in the neighbor's old field, and he woke and saw us, and unafraid, loped off. Each morning we rise alone from the shape of our bodies in flannel sheets, burrow beside burrow, where we dream of running, bleeding, food, feral sex, each to his or her own outlandish nightlife. We walk in the world We sip our coffee at a clean glass table. We love our child. Then come to an edge where the world meets the soul, and the soul knows once more what it holds. Such capacity to inflict harm or injury, easy as snowfall and fog's slow rise back. It does not, again and again. I hate the world. It batters too much the wings of my self-will. He's writing to Fanny, a few weeks cold after the nightingale. He hears it sing in lone, full-throated ease, and knows himself, grown specter thin, even in sweet incense, full summer. His sadness is a bell's bird call, tolling him back from thee to my soul self. He'll sail himself next year, a man post-poetry and posthumous, too numb to feel the sun over Naples, to heal his scavenger lungs. His hands are white, cold. His nails are ridged like a field. He writes to Brown, were I in health, it would make me ill. And means, of course, his heart's lack. White trees, white waves. Behind me, winter wind. It whips the sycamores, whose leaves are large as sheets of paper, brittle, brown, or blowing down. It shakes the blanched out trunks of beech. Despite the cold, it's humid, a warm exhaust of fog and breathing of the muds. Back down the path I cut one summer, down the ridge and up the drumlin rise beside the creek. You're reading, or you're watching out the window where I vanished with a dog. I learned when I should leave, the privacy you crave, as I do. The irony thereof. My Sheltie once, growling at his leash, loose. The coyote would kill him simply. So we watch. Long snout. Bone slender, his high rear hips. He's a reel of fog unspooling toward the far, half-shadowed rim of trees. Uptick of grackle, more wrens. He's loping now, he's running through the field toward the woods. By the time he is halfway, he is gone. Ditches for the poor. Class wanted to hear it. You got to read it, right? Somebody actually wants to hear a poem. Yes, I will read that. I'll read it twice. I'm Robert Bly. You want to hear it again? Ditches for the poor from the French. The Middle Ages, roughly as fossés aux pauvres, denoting common graves, by which we take to mean the practice of the period by which are sown into their shrouds the dead, the bodies then stacked. Language is, in itself, already skepticism, writes Levinas. A fissure opens, an opportunity for what? Clarity? Closure, perhaps, through which these instances of proximity may be. When the graves became crowded, there, imagine the 90 lumps, the layers of dirt dividing strata of bodies, the several yards by several yards hole. Having been filled, the church keeps redug the ditch, disinterred the nameless, in decay, to install the newer dead, old bones to the charnel hall. There is no narrative to such anguish, as from the corpse, no odor, as from a gathering loss, mere ennui. Think of the others, the grieving, living, waiting with their needles to stitch anew. I told class I would read another poem called "Tis a Failing," but I'm not going to, because I'm going to read some new poems, including a poem or two that kind of takes off after that one in the style thereof. So I'll do that instead. I'm reading poems from a book in aspiration. It's not yet. collection of poems I think I'm calling Scavenger Loop. And I think what I'm going to do is read about half a dozen of these poems. And I'm thinking, I've never done this, I'm thinking of these poems moving from a one attitude toward a voice to something very different, from a notion of a voice as a settled, singular thing, almost like a person, almost like a self, toward, I think, an increasingly dispersed or broken or baffled or complicated notion. You'll see. Anyway, that's the plan. This first one is just about my daughter. Actually, it's about being a dad. It's called On Arrogance. I thought I killed it. Too little water. Too much sunlight. Wrong pot. Bad plan. Whatever. So says my girl. When it's all too much to deal with. A difficult thing's easier to dismiss these days than face. I know. I hung three ferns on the porch so she would find it homey, like home had been. And I would too. Who knew the robins started there in stealth? By the time I saw their nest, the fern was sickly gray, a maw in the middle of fronds splayed like shocked hair. Twice I poured my spout of water beneath the nest, got buzzed, cussed, harped at from the power line running from the porch. Whatever. I let them go, and they were born. I hoisted neighbor kids for a look, tiny brown puddle of bodies in a cup, bottle, bubble, eyes, splayed beaks, such rapt new hunger. But not Katie. Not interested. I took pictures to show. Not Kate. They grew. And then, one on a Tuesday, the next two the next day, they flew. I hear her calling across long shadows of green yards some days. Or think I do. Today, it was the cat at the screen door, yowling to get back in, and him with a mouthful of bird. Good boy. He dropped it at my feet and stood there unblinking upward, wanting his simple scratch. And all I could think was, Jesus, David, now what have you done? Simile. This one wants to move a little step from the sort of pretty thing to something other, something compromised by. You'll see. Orange and midnight, the moth on the fringe tree. First it nags a bloom, sips and chews, then shakes the big flower, then its wings slow. Grows satiate, as in sex, then still, as the good sleep after. Each bloom a white torch, more than a tree's flower. Each is one of 10 or 12, conic, one of many, made of many, green, white, or white petals held out as by a hand from the reach of the limb. A field this morning was full of white moths. More in the side yard, in the blue bottle, lifting fog off the dew. White wings like paper over flames and floating awry or pieces of petal torn off. Weeks now my words on paper have burned. Burned and flown, like a soul on fire, with nothing to show but ash. And the ash flies too. Today in the news, so many martyrs. An unnamed suicide bomber took herself into the arms of flame and five others by her own hand. Whitman means the beauty of the mind is terror. Do you think I could walk pleasantly and well-suited toward annihilation? But there is no likeness beyond her body in flames, for its moment, no matter its moment. Yet the fringe bloom burns, yet the moth shakes and chews as insects. When the young maple grows covered with seeds, they are 1,000 green wings, like chain upon chain of keys, each with its tiny spark trying the black lock. A tumbler turns and clicks. The world once more fills with fire, and the body, like ash, is ash. Magnolia. This one goes some farther way down the road toward not a single voice. I think there are two people here. It's quite late. Things are dire. Things aren't well. And there is an intrusion of so much other kinds of language into the moment here, I think. This is one that I was thinking about, Tis a Failing. This is for the guys in class today. I was thinking about that poem and the voice in that poem is this one was coming along. Do you know the magnolia? Are there magnolias up here this far north? Are they? I didn't know. It's a very southern tree, and I didn't know if we had them. They're beautiful. I have one in my yard. They're an ancient, tens of millions of years old tree. We know this because of the flower that it has. Anyway, magnolia. We were done for. Things broken, things ugly, it being the shut end of night. Morning breaking, more like a bruise smeared through the wet few uppermost leaves. Not yet light so much as less dark. They shouldn't grow this far north. That's what the book says. What book? What I meant was, each day begins in the dark. That's useless. That's too late. That's a pathetic thing to say. Older than bees, the magnolia. More primitive, the book says, whose carpels are extremely tough. They do not flower in sepals. They do not want such differentiation in their flower parts, from whence the term tepals. They open the anthers, splitting themselves out. That's your melodrama. No, they split at the front, facing the flower center. 16-something, Pierre Magnol, morning, starting through them like a purple bruise, then a cloud, one small pale blue stretch mark, another, then another. That's not right. Flowers developed to encourage pollination by beetles, too early for bees, grew tough to avoid damage by said beetles. There you have it, Magnolia virginianae, subfamily Magnoliadii of the family Magnoliaceae. Relations have been puzzling taxonomists for a long time. To survive ice ages, tectonic up-tearing, slow drift of the continents, a distribution scattered, things too old for change, mutinous in the half-light, and malignant. Stop it, please, please. They shouldn't be this far north. They bloom in a cup of pink fire, each one lit by an old oil. Before us, the bees. Before us, the bees, the beetles. These trees, so what? We had walked out earlier, the porch, late, terrible, dark night. Their natural range, a disjunct dispersal, no light. The magnolia, the eye begins to see. Then the long, horrible scrape on its trunk, his single stretching paring of the bark back. But he didn't finish his discomfort, his antler velvet, a cloud of sawdust and scrapings beneath, like small remains of a cold fire, all night trying, then no longer trying. That's when we walked out. He must have run. I'm gonna do this. You got a handout, didn't you? Okay. We're gonna need the handout. This will be on the exam. I have to tell you a little story. This is a poem in five short parts called Five Odes on Absence. And the part I need to tell you a little about, do we know John Clare? We know John Clare's story? Some heads are yes, and oh, Really quickly. Same time period as Keats, lived much longer than Keats, shared the first publisher. John Clare was going to be a famous guy, a poet, so 1830s, 1840s, 1850s, 1860s in England. A beautiful, beautiful poet that we don't pay enough attention to. He wrote, ready, 3,000 poems. We think Emily Dickinson was amazing with her 1,800 or something like that. She was amazing. 1,800 poems of Emily Dickinson. 1,790 of them are great, too. John Clare didn't write a single great one, but they're just fantastically beautiful. The purest kind of innocent nature poet you could ever read, John Clare. Also probably the poorest person in England during his lifetime. He was just a mess. He didn't really have a job. He sort of gardened a little bit. He was good at it. He liked to grow stuff. He was coming of age at the time in England with the passing of the Enclosure Acts, and that tipped him over one of his many edges over which he tipped, and his many, many children. We don't know how many he had. It were a bunch of them. He spent a lot of time in asylums. We know this about Clare, decades in asylums. He decided to go home one day. You don't need to know any of this part. It's just a good story. He ran away from the asylum. He walked 85 miles home in 3.5 days. Do that. He had no food. He ate grass on the way home and got there to see his wife and probably 7 or 8 of the kids, and they were all gone. They were all gone. He walked all the way. They were gone. So back to the institution with Clare. One of his manifestations was a kind of remarkable paranoia. He thought his doctors were reading all his poems. They were. Guess that's not paranoia, right? They thought he was reading, they were reading his letters. They were. So he devised a code. He was going to outthink the doctors. He was going to write some letters to some of his wives. He had one, but they had different names. We don't really know. He's very slippery. He claims to have written Don Juan, too, and some of Shakespeare's plays. So he writes this code. The middle letter on the handout is one of the letters in code. Do you have that? I don't have that one. Can I borrow somebody for just a second?
I'll give it back.
All he did was take out the vowels. That'll fool him. So you can see, you see the middle letter? You see, my dearest Mary Collingwood, I am nearly worn out and want to hear from you. Nobody will want, see? He thought, I'm a wily guy. That was his, I'm showing you this because I take some of the lines from this letter in the first section of this poem, and I use the language that he used, but I'm going to read it as translated. On the back, it shows you the lines that I use and what he probably was really saying, like the first line, Im durst immer ruler, my dearest, I'm going to read the clarified part, but it looks like the other part. The other thing, this has nothing to do with my poem, but I'm going to read you the bottom letter too. This is the single saddest letter I've ever read in my life, ever, ever. I typed the date wrong. March 8, 1860. I'm going to read this one to you just because, well, shit. Dear sir, I am in a madhouse and quite forget your name and who you are. You must excuse me, for I have nothing to communicate or tell of, and why I am shut up, I don't know. I have nothing to say, so I conclude. Yours respectfully, John Clare. You don't know whether to just cry or let, you know, did Beckett write this or, well, anyway. Third part of this poem has some lines from some Clare poems, and I have some drafts of his poems where he's revised, and I know his revisions. And
I show two versions. I don't know how to indicate that. I'll probably just do something with my hand to show you where he's revising. I don't know. If I start flapping, just don't pay any attention to the man behind the curtain. And then it just gets... This is a poem about taking things out and about language that removes, like the language of Twitter, right? Twitter shows up in here. You've got 140 characters, and whatever you have to say has to fit in there. So you kind of leave stuff out, right? Leave some letters out. Just like Claire was doing. There's one section in here that is a real collision of language from Wikipedia and Twitter and the OED and some poems and the rhetoric of advertising and actually one advertising agency's. You'll see. Five odes on absence. My dearest, he starts, I am nearly worn out. And if purple's the new black, as Vogue says, according to their latest ad by tweet, it is the season's thing, perhaps erasures are poetry du jour. At the Walker, contemporary poets have been composing astounding new work by removing portions of existing. Nobody will want me or have me. And what have I done? Join us as several guest poets read from and display their latest or landmark erasures, which means take some Dickinson, rub some letters out, you can be famous too. Because I could not stop for death, make that be a cold sop. I stood at, you get the picture, Sappho, without time's injury. People tell me I have got no home in this world. Two. My neighbor's boy, Bernard, is practicing. Bang! Against his father's garage, painted a week ago. Taupe siding and light brown sliding doors trimmed out and edged in white. Bang! And three dozen grackles scatter off the ornamental crab where they had lit. Beautiful tree, to be so full of birds. Beautiful birds, whose shape maintains a tree. When they disperse, silhouette widening like a flower blooms or limbs in blue flight. Bang! And his skates scrape down the concrete drive. He taps his stick. He digs his rollers in. Bernard's usually dead-eye with a puck, but wild today. Thwack! Paint puff. One more scar on the door where he's missed the net once more. That's his father. Watching from the window. That's his mother, not there. Not there. Not there. Not there. Not there. Three. Mr. Clare wants a little privacy. Who can blame him? It's 1849, all his life he's tried to get the words right. The startled stock dove whizzing by, hurried by as the still hawk hangs over him, hangs over over the sky. In dusk, crows from the oak trees quacking, flusk, quacking, spring as they spring, wafting the stillness of the woods. Get the birds right. Get the trees. It's not code exactly. Now, he's the talkative inmate patient of Northampton County General Lunatic Asylum. And now, he's boxed with gypsies, written Don Juan, lived on grass, one mad escape home, and yet thou art not there. And now he writes to Mary Collingwood. Is she Mary Boland? Is she Patty? Dearest Mary, are you faithful? Or do you think of me pulling out the vowels? You did visit me in hell, leaving out the wise. Sometime back, foolish people tell me I have got no home in this world. Who can blame him? He gets confused,
weaving it this way, is faded all a thought, is faded all a hope. He lived in a house with 7 children. Where are they? He was the rage of London, peasant, poet, friend of... Where are they? Some days now he pulls weeds to keep busy. Though his doctors want him inside, enclosed, for safety's sake. He sings them little songs. I am, yet what I am, none cares or knows. My friends forsake me like a memory lost. I am the self-consumer of my woes. 3,000 plus poems in a lifetime. Not code, exactly. Not exactly not. But don't come here again, for it is a notorious bad place. Yours forever and ever and ever, John Clare. 4. Morandi paints a bottle by painting everything around the bottle, but not the bottle. This is how it always is. Wherever I am what is missing. Twittering, birdsong, tremble, high-pitched laughter, state of great agitation, quiver. I feel I am, I only know I am, and plod upon the earth as dull and void. The key word is verisimilitude. It's not enough to tell the truth. You have to tell it in believable fashion. Then buyers won't care what you omit. Earth's prison chilled my body with its dram of dullness, and my soaring thoughts destroyed. Twittering is writing messages of 140 characters or less, no matter the message, using copyright Twitter. These are live updates of what one's doing. I fled to solitudes from passion's dream. But now, I only know I am. That's all. 5. Some days Isaac sits on the deck all day. He holds his head. He drinks a lot. He weeps. The birds are landing, black, then purple, as the sun picks up the oils on their wings. The heavy crab grows heavier with them. The pink blossoms grow shivery like wings. I understand the patience. Sometimes I do. I wonder what Bernard sees when he sees the open net yawning there. Toward the end, Morandi painted fewer lines, bigger ghosts, made an edge with a sketch of edges behind the pale line of each edge. That's all it takes. Innuendo of a thing, the way now, bang, the grackles explode out again in a crazy puff of wings. Bernard's rage is the hard pink downfall of petals there, or not there, as he skates back down the drive. I sit with my magazines and cell phone. I feel crazy drifting by myself. Sometimes I think the birds are shadows of some other thing. I just can't see it well. Black, then purple turning black. You get the picture. On a better day, Claire writes, the starnels darken down the sky. But that's the price of time's erasures, too. Sad memories of a happy life. People make such mistakes. It isn't code. Where are, then what he doesn't write is you. I'll read 2 more. What you said. Whitman shows up in this one. These guys just keep popping up. Just walking around in the snow in this one, in the spring. What you said. But before I died, I smelled them. I could have missed them so quickly, rushing elsewhere. Captivation depends, don't you think, on willingness sometimes to be caught? Be called back as I once was, wet lowland, where they were, Leucosium vernum, honey-like. They have a slight fragrance and a bright white button of blossoms as soon as the snow melts in its wild habitat, or small, pill-shaped, pale, with a green, occasionally yellow spot at the end of each tepal. Did you find them soothing? Did you affiliate? Sane and sacred there, particularly in the singing. Don't you think it's too late? No, I was walking for my health. Lean down and savor there, heard bleeding, the thrush, throat, the lilac. You have gone too far. You say things so as not to say something else. I did wish to go back. Then you missed them. Too early for lilac. Tell me, where's elsewhere? I don't even know. What were they? Snowdrops, snowflakes, each to keep and all, and passed on as quick as that. You are everything that has not yet been lost, is what you said. Thank you for coming. I'll read one more poem. Thank you for listening. Thank you for inviting me today to this beautiful place. Too many. Too many, my neighbors say, when what they mean are deer, the foragers, a few at a time, fair, if little more than rats, according to my farmer friend nearby, whose corn means plenty. They nip the peaches and one bite ruins, hazard every road with their running into headlights, not away, a menace, plague, something should be done. Or, here in town, where I found a kind of afterlife, the townies hate the damage to their variegated hostas, shade-side ferns. What they do inside white bunkers of the county's one good course is criminal. Deep scuffs through the sand. That's one thing, but lush piles of polished olive droppings, hoof ruts in the chemically and color-enriched green. Yet, here's one more, curled like a tan seashell, not a foot from my blade, just come to the world fawn, speckled, wet as a trout, which I didn't see, hacking back brush beneath my tulip poplar. It's not afraid, mews like a kitten, can't walk. There are so many, too many of us. The world keeps saying, and the world keeps making this makes no sense more.
Thank you. Thank you.
I don't know the reference to Jude in that last poem, though. You heard something that I didn't hear. What was it?
Because we are too many.
I knew that. Fabulous. Thank you. What else don't I know? We could fill the room. Yeah.
I have a leftover question from our class. Uh-oh. After you left, I mean, we had some good questions after you left. One was, somebody brought up the difference between work, poetry when you read it on the page.
Yeah.
How it offers one thing, and poetry when we listen to it, and how it seems to offer something different. And I wonder how you think about that. It's such a pleasure to hear them, and they're so different somehow than when I'm reading them and getting the enjambments and so on. So I wondered how you're thinking, what is given when a poem is read, particularly your work, that perhaps doesn't come across when it's on the page, or vice versa, what comes across when it's on the page that we don't get when it's read?
Did you hear all that? Yeah, that's a fantastic, she answered the question. It was. I certainly don't think they're one thing. A poem's got two lives. at least, or 400, but it has some kinds of capable virtues on the page, and it has some other potential virtues out loud as music. I mean, if you look at a musical score, that's one thing, but if you hear somebody perform, oh, you know, a Chopin etude or something, it's a whole different thing than on the page. It's the difference between a visual art and a heard one, isn't it? There's a difference between painting and music. I think very hard about how they look on the page and how a sentence moves through its line breaks and through its phrasing and how all of those things have a kind of visual command or expectation and how we don't have to abide by those things out loud. I don't read line breaks. There's some people who really pronounce line breaks, and I don't. I understand that and that's honorable. But I just like to explore the different virtues. I was a musician in a better life, and I've played a lot of music, and I like to think about just the effects that the sounds have, the sounds that the mouth can make. Sure. Questions? Okay. Signing. Live long and prosper. There's a Star Trekkie back there. Yeah. Thank you again.
This has been a production of Cornell University on the web at cornell.edu.